Welcome to the Family Office Real Estate Institute podcast, where we explore family offices, real estate, and the art of preserving legacies and wealth. I'm DJ Van Kuren, and I'm going to be utilizing my experience of investing on behalf of a number of prominent families and working directly for a number of prominent families on their real estate portfolio. I'm going to tap into my decades worth of experience in real estate investing and relationships with some of the most prominent family office leaders in the industry, academics from universities around the world, and industry experts and leaders in the real estate space. So whether you're a family member, family office executive, family office, or real estate enthusiast, Family Office Real Estate Institute podcast will empower you with knowledge and influential voices. I'm DJ Van Kuren, and this is the Family Office Real Estate Institute podcast. Welcome to another session of Family Office Real Estate Insights. Today we have Michael Fellman with MSF Capital. Michael, we've known each other for quite a number of years now, actually. Yeah. And so thanks so much for being on the show.
Thank you for having me, and thank you for asking me to be on.
Well, you're definitely a wealth of knowledge with your experience, but why don't we start a little bit with, the background from a family office perspective, what's that transpired to, how it started, and where you are today?
Yeah, sure. So my training is as a lawyer. I'm originally from the Boston area. I came to New York for law school. I practiced law for about 13 years. That was like the 90s into like late 90s. Primarily litigation, but also had a fairly large real estate practice as a lawyer back in the 90s. Doing closings, primarily single families, two family homes, a business with maybe 8-10 apartments, that type of real estate. Then I've gone on to do some interesting things. I started a sports and entertainment company. That led me to start an angel group. I started angel investing. That wasn't even in New York, but that was in Washington, D.C. That's a much longer story. Why Washington, D.C.? And we did typical angel deals, started off with a movie project, but we ended up doing movies. We did a couple restaurants. We did some multifamily apartment buildings in D.C., did some tech companies. And that's when I started my first family office, single family office called FLLC with my two brothers to originally make angel investments. We still have FLLC. We don't do angel investing anymore. But that was really the genesis of our family office, all first generation wealth. I made quite a bit of money as an attorney. My younger brother, Harvey, was a pretty senior executive at JP Morgan. And then my older brother has worked in the pharma industry until he just retired about 2 years ago now. And it was just six of us. It was five men, one woman. And I got lucky, really. Turned out that two people in my angel group who are still with me today, 24 years later, come from two of the wealthiest families in this country. I'm 100% you and your audience would know who they are. But they were cousins, so they didn't have the famous last names. But eventually they told me what families they were with. Eventually they brought their other cousins into these, like I said, these angel type deals. And then eventually those two families asked me to help them in other business and investments. And that's in about 2002-ish is when I created MSF Capital Advisors, which is what I call a family office advisory practice. I can get into what we do in a minute. And what that now has grown into is I've got two partners. 3 admin people, 8 analysts, and 35 family clients that we do work for. What's the work we do? We are not money managers. We are not an RIA. We have no discretion. Really, what we do is source diligence. I emphasize the word diligence, myself and my 8 analysts. And then we co-invest between myself and my 2 partners into whatever we advise our family office clients. I mean, similar to what I did as a lawyer, where I had a bunch of clients that I did work for. Very similar model to that. The other niche that I've developed over the years is that most of our clients are not in the U.S. They're in Europe, they're in Asia, Middle East, LATAM, Central America, and we do have some U.S., but the bulk of our clients are non. How that happened for me, I won't get into my partners to make this shorter story, is the last movie project I worked on. I got introduced to a very large family in Europe. The wealth was created in real estate, one of the largest still today of owners of real estate in Central Europe. But they also had a venture arm and have been in, I think, 10 or 12 unicorns. Originally through an internal venture fund or venture arm they had, eventually got spun out, and now they're still the biggest LP in the fund. They did not invest in my movie project, but what I do for them is I kind of manage their U.S. investments, all tech companies, not real estate, and been involved with that family for now over 20 years. The sectors that we focus on, I think the most relevant one here is real estate. Mostly multifamily. And when we own, again, when I say we, clients of MSF, have a pretty large real estate holdings globally, not through one family, but about through 10-ish or so, 10, maybe 11. And many of them have been in real estate 30, 40, 50 years. One of our families in Brazil since 1920, their family has been investing in real estate in Brazil. And that's what we do for these families, particularly in real estate, is, again, we source diligence and co-invest into these various opportunities. They tend to own, operate, manage the real estate. We've done some JVs. We've also done some, we also like lending. That's another sector we like. We have our own bridge lending operation, but we are LPs in a few others in the U.S. only so far. But we do others in real estate. But for this, I know real estate's the key.
So all these investors or families, should we say, from different parts of the world, they come together and they will invest into other parts of the world as well?
Yeah.
And is a lot of that done with the same families that are part
many
of your-
times it is. I mean, part of what we do at MSF, I'll give you a couple of examples. Like for us, I'm really no help to them in their own country, right? They know their own country. Like I said, they've been investing, owning real estate in their own country for decades, but it's when they want to invest outside their country. That's where our firm gets involved. And in many cases, what we do is we put them together. Let's say it's a real estate family in Brazil and it's a real estate family in the US, right? We will then put those two families together to put some kind of almost like a JV together, right? So we do a lot of cross-border transactions. As I said, myself and my partners will put our own capital in that. We do have institutional investors who also come along depending on the size of the investment. But we do a lot of, we're almost like for some degree, the ears and eyes on the ground We're not the management company, but we kind of are the liaison between the manager. Say they hire a management company here if they're foreign, big management company. We are kind of the liaison between the management company and the family who may be in Hong Kong or Dubai or whatever, right? So we kind of act as the, hopefully if there's small fires, we put them out before they become big fires. And so,
So do you have to deal with any of the cross-border legal aspects, financial aspects, you know, because, I would imagine in some cases there might be some hedging, or how do you go about the cross-border transactions themselves?
Yeah. So one of my partners, like myself, is an attorney, but was a tax attorney. And so structuring these things, now we use outside counsel. We don't do any of that legal structuring, although we work with the attorneys and obviously we can speak their language and monitor them. But we do not draft the documents ourselves. And so many times there's, a typical situation in most of our transactions is you've got two typically hold codes that come together. Then there's the new code, then there's the blockers, and then there's the actual entity that holds the asset. And so structuring for us is a very, I like to say, depending on where the money's coming from and depending on where the money's going. So we look at tax treaties, we look at obviously the different tax situations, and we rely heavily on our accounting firms and our legal counsel to make sure that everything is done in a tax efficient way, and to avoid any, tax, pitfalls or whatever.
So let's talk a little bit about, primarily the people that listen to these interviews are U.S. based. We do have some that are international, but can you sort of elaborate a little bit on blockers, if there's any specific, what they are, how they work, and, any specific jurisdictions that you like better than others?
Well, yeah, I don't want to give legal advice.
No, this is not legal advice, but the general.
It's similar. I mean, I would say it's very similar to if we take a fund investment, right, where you may invest into an offshore feeder, right, and then invest into, let's say it's a U.S. manager, right? It is not exactly the same, but it is very similar to something like that, where if it's a foreign capital, we've used BVI, we've used Cayman, we've used Luxembourg, years ago we used Mauritius when we're doing India. It all really depends on the tax treaty, and it depends on where the money is coming from and where the money is going.
Which is very important. What you brought up before is making sure that you're working with the right professionals, right, to make sure that these get implemented correctly. What are some mistakes that you've seen with some of these cross-border transactions? Have you ran across any of those, whether it was something you guys learned or that you've seen happen?
Look, at the end of the day, right, it's all about your local partner. Right. And if you don't have a good local partner, you can run into issues of accountability and transparency, and things can, as you know, can go off the rails pretty quickly. And so I think having a good local partner, depending on where you're investing, if you're a foreign investor investing into the U.S., having a good local partner. And that's why, be frank, that's why many foreign investors will invest with a Blackstone or somebody like that, where they know that they've got the infrastructure. They know that they've obviously got the track record and all that business, and they have a comfort level. Even if there's a sacrifice, perhaps on the return side, because they're probably generating, in many cases, and depending on the economic cycle of that home country, they're probably generating a considerable amount of cash locally, right? And then deciding where do they want to deposit their cash outside their home country. Could be political reasons, could be economic reasons, it could be a host of reasons, right? But you know, so that's always a determining factor. I don't think they expect to become billionaires in the foreign country, but the wealth from what we've seen, and our families are all still active in their operating companies, the wealth is still created from the operating company in the home, wherever they are.
Right. So what percentage would you say of the investors are foreign investors into the U.S. and U.S. families into other countries?
Yeah. So we are, let me answer it this way. We are global investors. We, for example, we have investments, not all in real estate, but we have investment. Oh, we have some in real estate in Africa, for example. We have in Central Asia, Southeast Asia, obviously Latin America. Very hard, for example, to convince a U.S. family to invest into, let's say, a real estate project in Africa. I'm not saying it's impossible, but it's a very hard lift, right? Our clients who have invested in Africa and in African in real estate have come from, I would call, the usual suspects, Europe, Asia, Middle East, right? I think one of the attractions for foreign investors into U.S., let's just take U.S. real estate, is because, again, they feel safe here. They feel like there's a rule of law. They feel like they're, you know, the government is just not going to one day decide, you know what, I'm going to confiscate your property, which can happen in many of the countries, particularly in some of the ones we're in. And so a lot of foreign investors feel like the U.S. market is still a good market. Now, caveat with that is that most of them, I won't say all, but most of them only want to look at, you know, what we've deemed gateway cities.
Major cities.
You know, whether it's New York or Boston or, you know, L.A. or Chicago, and obviously, you know, if you're talking about Latin America, Miami to me is like a suburb of Latin America, right? Yeah. A lot of Latin American money in particularly in Miami, but in Florida in general, right? And so the challenge from my perspective, because I'm the one doing the diligence on this thing, is that in many cases, you know, the returns are pretty low in some cases, or not optimal from what I would consider, or what a U.S. investor might consider as some kind of either a benchmark or expected return or whatever you want to call it. And then obviously, too, I mean, I get these calls all the time like, well, is the Empire State Building for sale or Plaza for sale? Sometimes it gives me a headache because I would argue if you did the work, you may not want to buy those plates. You may not want to buy those iconic pieces of real estate.
Yeah.
In fact, if you've been following the news and the one of the owners of the Chrysler Building is an Austrian family that's in some kind is in a lot of financial trouble right now. So, you know, it's tough from my perspective to say, you know what, I don't think this is a really good deal at a one cap, right? Which is what a lot of New York prime real estate. But on the other hand, I hate to use this as an analogy, but I've been doing this for a long time. They almost look at real estate like a bank. Now, what do I mean by that?
Or a bond.
It's a bond where, hey, I park my money there.
Mm-hmm.
It's relatively safe in the sense that even if you look at on the downside, right, on the downside of real estate cycles, places like New York have, you know, not totally collapsed, or maybe there's a 20% correction, 25% correction, but it always seems to bounce back in the long term.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yes, in the short term, there could be issues, again, depending on leverage and a lot of other things. Foreigners don't tend to like to use, I find my U.S. clients using more leverage than my foreign clients. Whether we've been conditioned that way, you know, I say leverage can be your friend or your foe.
Mm-hmm.
But I find what my foreign clients would prefer to do is buy it mostly cash, and or if not all cash, and then refinance maybe a year or two later, you know, at some LTV, maybe 50%, 40%, use that proceeds from that refinancing and go buy something else.
Right.
And that's what I mean by the bank, is yep. They use their real estate as almost like a bank.
Mm.
Right. And so I've seen that from my Asian, my Middle Eastern, even some of the European, where they touch it, they feel it. They feel it's in a good economy, good city. They feel safe coming here. Like, we have clients that still have bodyguards in Latin America.
Mm-hmm.
Kidnapping is still a problem in a lot of these countries. And so, you know, the U.S. will still continue. Now, my U.S. clients are more focused on the return, the IRR, and they're more willing to look at perhaps secondary or tertiary cities. I want to say as a general rule, but I would say from foreign clients, that's still a heavy lift, and it's still a lot of it's education. About looking at some of these other cities where maybe the returns are better. But if you're looking at it from essentially investing excess cash out of their existing business, say it's real estate or non, then it's a little different outlook, and it's a little longer period of time that they can take for their investments, right? So we don't have... With fortunate enough that I don't have the issue of people having to live off their investments. It's really for a long-term growth, and therefore you can take a longer horizon on your investments.
You know, when you talk about the major markets, and looked into a study actually about 5 years ago, maybe that showed that the liquidity was pretty much the same in these, you know, major markets like you were talking about compared to the secondary markets, but there is that feeling of safety. You can write bigger checks, right? And New York is an anonymity because people from all around the world are moving there. They're not necessarily moving to, Tennessee, right? Even though that could be a great market in Nashville. So you definitely are, they're much more aware of that. What about the debt? You know, with where we're at, the interest rates, we had great interest rates, but now they've been rising. So some of these foreign investors, are they bringing over debt of sorts on some of the properties from overseas, or are they using the U.S., or is there opportunity for these foreign families to provide debt in the States?
Well, I think there is some, and again, I don't want to get into tax law or whatever, but sure. I believe there are some advantages for a foreign family to invest in a debt vehicle as opposed to an equity vehicle, particularly if they're not the operator, right? So if they're just a passive, let's say a passive investor, passive LP, I believe there is, and it's, I think it's not that much different for a U.S. investor, right? If you show that you are active in the, in managing the real estate and all that, that there, you know, you have more tax efficient laws than if you're just a passive, right? Whether it's UBIT or some of these other tax laws. And I think it's not that much different on the foreign side. But if you're not, then I think there is a provision where it's more tax efficient if you're doing it as debt alone or mm-hmm. something of that nature. What we are seeing, though, is foreign clients of ours who at one point maybe did not want to either become a U.S. citizen or really set up U.S. operations of their corporation, really taking a different attitude. And I'm not necessarily talking about the EB-5 program, which is, has made, believe it or not, some kind of resurgence, but really setting up these kind of, you know, whether it's South Dakota or Wyoming or some of these other states, actually setting up an LLC there or a trust there, and then investing out of that U.S. trust into some type of a project or fund or whatever, because then it's now looked at as a U.S.
entity. Investment. Yeah.
Yeah.
I do know, and it escapes me right now, but there's definitely a benefit, a tax benefit from a foreign family providing debt here in the U.S. And I forgot what that number is, if it's 10 or 11% or whatever the case is, but there's definitely some benefits for that to happen. And it is, you know, especially in real estate, if you get first position, it's much better for that. You know, you had
They'll kind of set it up almost as like a wholly owned sub, a U.S. wholly owned sub type thing. Again, if they're going to be more active in the operation, if they're not, and I think there's a benefit. Again, I don't want to, you know, please check with your attorney, your accountant, CPA, whatever. But I think there is, if you're passive as a foreign investor, it is more tax advantageous to you to, I think, be a debt investor or a loan or whatever, however you want to characterize that. I mean, there's certainly, we work with big law firms on this. And so I would recommend that you consult with your attorney or your CPA on that if you're a foreign investor.
So a couple things, just to backtrack a little bit, you know, some of the key points that you brought up, first and foremost, that if you are going to invest internationally, you do want a local partner. You know, I don't know if you knew this or not, but 2000, 2003, I lived in Asia, in Vietnam, and this is when they were, you know, it was the second hardest place to do business in the world. And having a JV was so, one, it was required, but also extremely important, because there are a lot of people lost their shirt by just giving it to parties that they didn't really know, right? And so you do have to have that solid partner in whatever country you have. Correct me if I'm wrong, but actually investing alongside an actual family who does have experience, their own money into it, would increase that level of, I don't want to use the word safety, but of surety.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in many countries, you need it anyways. I mean, you need the local entity, the local partner to own 51% of the enterprise anyways, right? And then the foreign can own 49, or, I mean, there's a few different, but essentially, that's as a general rule. And again, look, if you were in the U.S. and let's say you wanted to get involved in let's say real estate in Africa? Like, are you going to really know all the regulations? Are you going to know all the people that you should deal with, you shouldn't deal with? I would say that a good way to lose your shirt is if you don't do those type of things. But, you know, the other thing I would say is that these type of partnerships do take time to form. I can tell you from my own experience that it just doesn't happen overnight. Like I think one of the problems that people have when they try to attack foreign capital that's not institutional, I'm talking more like, you know, families, is they really want to get to know you first as a person. They want to break bread. They want to, you know, have a meal and get to know you, your family, know who you are as a person, references. Hopefully, maybe there is a common, maybe you have a common friend or acquaintance in common that may have been the original reason why the two of you met. The business comes second. And I think that's, to some degree, gets lost in this country, right? Sometimes we think the business comes first and everything else comes second. I can tell you in these other countries, the people come first and the relationships come first and the business comes second. It's not saying they don't want to make money. Of course they do. But it's really getting to know you as a person, your family, who you are. Can I trust you? Obviously a warm introduction is key if it can be. Otherwise, it's just going to take you a much longer period of time to do business.
Here in the U.S., as you know, I mean, relationships is the name of the game too with families here, and to build that trust. Do you think it's more so with the international families?
From my experience, I've been doing this 4 or 5 years already now. I find that here it tends to be very transactional first, then, you know, the rest of it's great, where I feel like overseas, it's the relationship first, then the transaction. I can't say that in every case, but I would say as a general rule, I would say the relationship, because these relationships, I've seen it even in country, they tend to be long-term relationships, even if within the same country. It's funny. I did this study once years ago because I started off in Middle East and Bahrain, and then I went over to Dubai and Abu Dhabi, and now I've been mostly focused in Saudi Arabia. And one of my Chinese clients asked me to do this study because they were looking to do a JV with one of the families in a particular, not real estate, a different industry. And what I found was that, and I'm not sure if this is true today, but the study was maybe 10 years old, that if you're a family in Dubai, you most likely don't even do business with a family in Abu Dhabi, that you've only do business with. It's to some degree, I don't want to sound sexist or anything, or not sexist, but racist, I maybe even, but it's almost tribal in the sense that you only do business with people in your own country. You won't even venture out to your neighboring country, even though you're all considered part of the Middle East or the GCC, that it's really like, if you're in Saudi, you're doing business with Saudi families. If you're in Dubai, you're doing business with Dubai. And yeah, it was very weird. I that was not the result I thought it was going to be. And again, I'm not sure if that's still true today. I think probably my guess it is to some degree, but maybe if you're in China, maybe you don't do business with Hong Kong or Singapore or Japan or whatever. So I find like you almost tend to do business with people who are like yourself, which you could say is a general, from a psychology point of view, is tends to happen anyways. But I've seen that.
A lot of it is cultural.
For example, I'll give you another one. I found particularly, like, for example, Brazil and Argentina, those two families don't, from what I know, don't do a lot of business together. Now, maybe they see themselves as competitors. I don't know, but I haven't really seen a lot of that. And Brazilians tend to do with Brazilians, Argentinians with Argentinians. But I don't see, for maybe the cup again. I don't know the answer to that question.
Well, so there's definitely cultural differences, right? In different parts of the world, and you know, much more family oriented or much more, like you said, relationship oriented. I mean, I can tell you from my time in Vietnam, there were certain ethnicities that Vietnamese didn't want to do business with. You know, they're just like, I'm not doing business with the blank, you know, and that's just how they grew
up. It could be religious too. I mean,
yes.
Even, you know, Sunni versus Shia, right? Yep. And, you know, it's still technically Muslim, but you could be in the same country. And if you're a Shia and another person's Sunni, you may not, or Hindu versus Muslim or whatever, right? And so you see those, look, people are human beings, right? And people have biases. My background's in political science, college, obviously law, but I was a cultural anthropologist, was my second major. And I find, like, if you don't get the culture of doing business right, never get the business right. And so I find that has been a big help. And not like I've always got it right, but I'm at least sensitive and cognizant of that, where sometimes a lot of people are not. So. Right.
I think you bring up a very, very good point. And I learned that the hard way when I was in Saigon. Here in the US, you know, you ask somebody to come like this and your fingers are up. Well, actually, they need to be down when you're calling somebody over, because that's how you call dogs, is when it's sticking up. And I had no idea, and I didn't mean any disrespect whatsoever, but until a Vietnamese told me that, I was like, wow. So there's definitely a lot of cultural aspects and a lot more that you have to be aware of when you are dealing in these other countries because of different, you know, aspects, right? Yeah. So it's not just...
I also find that again, I'm a little bit generalizing, but I find that particularly with foreign families, they tend to take a little more time in deciding what to do. Now, that can be very frustrating for you if you have a project or whatever. But I find that, and I think that's one of the reasons why I think they really want to take time to get to know who you are. And I'm not talking like a week or 2 weeks or a month or a few months. I mean, really talking could be a year, could be even more.
Yeah.
Before they really, and look, I've seen that from my perspective where sometimes even with a warm intro, it may take me a year or two, or maybe sometimes I've had three or four before the family felt comfortable working with me. So I've seen it from my end personally. I've seen it with their business dealings. What's interesting though is on the flip side of that, once you do get their trust, it's very hard to lose it. Even if you screw up, or, you know, unless you just outright steal, but even if you screw up, they're, believe it or not, willing to give more chances, I find. And and you know, as long as the trust factor is still there, like if you're going behind their back or something like that and you violated the trust, yes. But if you haven't, and it's purely a investment decision necessarily, or a some cases an operational decision, they seem to be very, in many cases, forgiving of that. And, you know, especially if they've known you and done business with you and, you know, over a long period of time.
Michael Fellman with MSF. We could go on for quite some time. And so I want you to come back. But you know, this international discussion is one that I haven't had, at least in an interview like this. And so this has been very enlightening, and I know it'll be very beneficial for many people. So we'll definitely have to come back and have you on the show. But thanks so much for being part of this. And, you know, your insight and your experience is tremendous, and as well as your friendship. So thanks for being on the show.
Yeah, thank you for being my friend as well, DJ.